Thank you. Yeah, that was no fight. That was a love-in Ed and I had. So it's a real pleasure to be here today. I was really delighted when Mark invited me. And what I'd like to do is dive into this. And I do think John should keep an eye on the governing board, though. It occurred to me, being involved in nomenclature for so many years, one possible pronunciation would be sissy bee. So keep an eye on the pollen pig scientists. They may pick up on that. So what I want to do today is describe what I see as a problem facing taxonomy, some of the opportunities associated with what we might do to respond to that, and then conclude by describing some of the things we're doing at an institute that I've went to ASU to found, Arizona State University, called the International Institute for Species Exploration. And I'll give you a better idea of what we're trying to do there. As most of us are painfully aware, in universities, taxonomy is simply disappearing from the curriculum. This has certainly been true for a long time in the US, it's true in Europe, and I recently was told by colleagues at the British Museum that they have taught the one sort of surviving course in systematic methodology for several years there, and that one is on the verge of going all molecular and cutting out all the other older sort of material. And taxonomists are simply not seen as essential members of many faculties and universities any longer. There's a widening disconnect, even within museums, between collections and the taxonomic research that used to take place there. And of course, it's that taxonomic research that adds and maintains as reliable the information associated with those specimens, which presumably is the reason to acquire and maintain those specimens. And also, there's insufficient energy and resources being invested in growing and developing collections so that they're more able resources for us to use in our response to the biodiversity crisis. Whoops, I seem to be going backwards. That's not new, as Chuck can affirm. Now I need to go backwards. Okay, we'll get there. Taxonomy today is often only supported, at least by name, when it's combined with the goals of some other related or sometimes unrelated field, or coupled with a currently popular technique. It's of great concern that a window of opportunity that remains open for some short and indeterminate period of time to explore and document the end results of several years of evolutionary history is rapidly closing, and yet the scientific community is doing relatively little to position us to explore and document species before most of those opportunities disappear. And decisions are being made by society about how to deal with very severe issues of introduced non-native species, conservation, introduction of vectors, and so forth, with minimal baseline information about what species exist and where. I mean, what hope do we have of detecting or monitoring increases or decreases in biodiversity unless we have that baseline? So, taxonomy has been the Rodney Dangerfield of sciences for a while, and this is unfortunate, and some of its most vocal apologists have come from within taxonomy. And I would argue since the 1940s, there's been pretty evident examples of sort of excusing taxonomy. And in the 1940s, well, it's, you know, not quite population biology, but if you kind of squint your eyes and look at it funny, you can kind of make it out to be. And each and every one of these attempts, whether it was a mathematical bent with phonetics between the late 50s and the 70s, electrophoresis, which was one of the early technological tools that I was told when I was a grad student would replace taxonomy and there would be no future, tropical ecology in the 80s, or molecular genetics since the 90s. In each case, often well-intentioned efforts to link taxonomy to these other disciplines has inevitably failed to promote the core issues of taxonomy, but rather to promote the other discipline. Sharon Kingsland, in her book Modeling Nature, pointed out that during the great cladistic debates in the 1970s, that these debates were very warranted because what was at stake was the reputation of taxonomy as a vibrant evolutionary science rather than as a backwater of biology. And it can be argued that we were winning that battle, and winning it well, so well, in fact, that cladistics has become widespread in biology. Virtually every biologist uses a branching diagram now to provide some sort of evolutionary context to whatever it is they're studying. And yet, ironically, taxonomy itself is close to becoming that backwater. From the same book, if you take her quotation about the impact of Robert MacArthur in descriptive ecology, and you substitute taxonomy for ecology in this quote, and you substitute Willie Hennig for Robert MacArthur, you come up with Willie Hennig both reinvigorated taxonomy and set off new debates on the place of theoretical reasoning in this descriptive science. And I think it's instructive to think about the lingering impact that these two incredible individuals had on these two fields of descriptive inquiry. One of the things that we seem to have lost sight of is that to Hennig and to taxonomists for several centuries, analyzing and understanding morphology was an end in itself. It was not merely a means to recognize species or a means to recognize monophyletic groups of species, but rather it was an intellectual puzzle to be solved in and on its own, of its own accord. Part of the reason that the Hennigian revolution was cut short was an overemphasis on acquiring trees, and again, there was great pressure from other fields of biology to have access to those trees, and a coupled de-emphasis on the characters themselves. The emphasis on trees as opposed to formal Linnaean classifications, and the emphasis on service to other branches of biology rather than the needs of an independent taxonomy. Gary Nelson has suggested that DNA has become the new fossil record. In 1925, Matthews said that fossils, when abundant enough, are a direct revelation of the true genetic sequences that explain evolution. Nelson suggests that today, DNA sequences are truer sequences even than those fossil ones, and that these too give us a revelation of the real history of organisms in time and space, phylogeography. Obviously, Gary's making fun of that comparison and certainly doesn't believe that. What Gary pointed out to us is that evidence and not revelation is the relevant concern for a taxonomist. And Zimmerman in 1957, who of course was very influential in Hennig's thinking, pointed out that the only true phylogenetic analysis is that of the character. And taking this to one of its logical extremes, Joe Felsenstein says that he now belongs to the I don't care school of thought in taxonomy. And to quote Joe, the focus of systematics has shifted massively away from classification. It is the phylogenies that are central, and it is nearly irrelevant how they are used in taxonomy. Well, this is an easy thing to say if you're a population geneticist and you work on a handful of species. It's another thing if you're an entomologist and there are 925,000 species. The emphasis on those cladograms has become so profound that systematics has largely been reduced to a service industry and is not pursuing those core questions of its own. And I would suggest that DNA barcoding has us precariously close to making the same mistake in alpha taxonomy that we made in cladistics, and that this has set the stage for a similarly service-oriented alpha taxonomy, a DNA barcode approach that abandons theoretical reasoning at the species level. And when I argue about DNA barcoding with some of its advocates, Dave Schindel and others assure me over and over that we're only providing another identification tool. Why are you upset? Well, first of all, it's a questionable identification tool, but to that extent, it is a useful additional tool. But if you look at the International Barcode of Life website, they say explicitly that sequence diversity in short standardized gene regions, that is DNA barcodes, enable both the identification of known species and the discovery of new ones. So I question the veracity of the claim that this is only for identification of known species. Several interesting recent papers do point out, I think, really encouraging and rational ways to apply DNA barcodes in really defensible and useful ways. Little and Stevenson had a fair amount of empirical data and concluded that indeed it is a useful identification tool, although not profoundly more useful than traditional morphological means of identifying species, but with an important caveat, that it's only useful if we have a library of known species against which we're comparing those sequences. Kelly Miller and his co-authors used DNA barcoding, I thought in a very clever way, to associate semaphorons. They used it to associate diticid larvae with adults, and the goal was to more quickly access the larval morphology, and this was a very clever way to get at it more quickly. And then recently, Fisher and Smith's revision in PLOS is groundbreaking in the sense of there being a revision there, and this does look like a far more balanced and sensible use to indicate places where there is so much genetic variation that it does bear closer inspection, and indeed in some of those cases new species emerged. Well, we have now to turn to opportunity, and we have the opportunity to make the 21st century the century of taxonomy, and there are many reasons to think that we'd better do this. Certainly the 22nd century will be, by comparison, a depauperate world to explore and a far less rewarding field of taxonomy to work in. We really are the last generation with a chance to document much of the evidence of evolutionary history, so we really should inventory as many species as we can. And in the process, we should easily be able to inventory more than any previous generation. And sadly, because of the biodiversity crisis, we almost certainly can document more species than in any subsequent generation. It's important, too, that we return and complete the Hennigian Revolution. We were so close on the road to Hennig's incredible vision for a general reference system that would allow all biologists to put into context all comparative relevant information. But this unfortunately was cut short, and we've divorced formal classifications and nomenclature from the hypotheses that we come up with for phylogeny. We need to educate the workforce that will populate the next generation of taxonomists, and we need to engineer a new infrastructure, primarily in terms of cyber infrastructure, to accelerate the work of taxonomy. And we need to establish taxonomy firmly as an ongoing enterprise, essential to and integral to and at the center of biology. Often, I've read some quotes, well, one in particular I can recall, Dan Jansen in one paper pointing out that, you know, we would complete the description of species and then move on to do other studies about them. But in reality, that initial discovery of a species is just the first step in exploring that species. As most people in this room will appreciate, it's an ongoing exercise that never ends. So I suggest that as taxonomists, we need to declare our independence primarily from experimental biology. We need to state our own goals and agenda, assert our own theories, reassert the epistemology that makes our hypotheses so rigorous. We need to demand the infrastructure that we require for our work in terms of collections and in terms of cyber infrastructure, work to our own standards of excellence, and remind ourselves that we need not seek or receive the approval of experimentalists to assert and value our own work. Taxonomy, if you think about it, has always asked enormously large questions. In fact, I think it would be reasonable to argue this was the first truly big science. It was so audacious of Linnaeus to set out to document all the species of the world. And it remains a big question. Unfortunately, until now, we didn't have tools by which taxonomists could actually approach this on the planetary scale that the questions exist. We have collections that, for very good reasons, have grown up to be provincial or national in focus, whereas the science demands that we compare all related species in a monophyletic group, regardless of where they might occur. And it's reminding ourselves as well that Hennig's work only had its impact in the mid-1960s, just a few decades ago. So we're really in the infancy of realizing the potential of this field. These are the questions that Joel Craycraft identified a number of years ago as the core big questions of taxonomy, and I think it captures them well. So what are Earth species? What are their phylogenetic relationships? What are their unique combinations of characters, and what's the history that explains the transformations of those characters? Where are they distributed in geographic and ecological space, and how have those distributions changed through time? And what are the most predictive classifications and informative names by which we can arrive at Hennig's general reference system? And I would suggest that the best service that any other biologist can receive from taxonomy is derived from taxonomy done for its own sake. When it's done with passion and with genuine intellectual interest, the results are inevitably better, more reliable, more extensive. And that we need to really focus on fundamental taxonomy, deriving that general reference system, and then that general reference system is the source for all the various user communities that depend on applications of taxonomy to solve problems. We need to dispel the myth that taxonomy is merely descriptive. And I don't know if I've ever heard the word descriptive used without merely in front of it, which is kind of a strange etymological circumstance. But it's important, first of all, to recognize that we do have hypotheses at multiple levels when we do so-called descriptive taxonomy, whether it's homology across species, hypotheses of synapomorphy, hypotheses of species or clades. And I'll put these hypotheses up against the most rigorous experiments you can offer by comparison. Being a pauperian, each and every one of these categories of hypotheses are all or nothing statements about the world, and there are no statements that are more open, more vulnerable to potential refutation than all or nothing statements. And so these are actually more scientific, more rigorous than any experimental design I've ever seen. So why we should allow this to be belittled in light of experimental biology is hard to understand. The other response to the criticism that we're merely descriptive was this quote that I really love from David Grimaldi and Mike Engel last year in Bioscience. They said biology's equivalent of stellar and oceanic cartography is taxonomy, and the morphology on which it is based, including old-fashioned natural history observations. Yet, unlike these analogous fields, taxonomy is derided as anachronistic, which is ironic given that taxonomy is still making startling discoveries in a rapidly disappearing natural world. And to illustrate the last point, this is a photograph of Dr. George Beccaloni in London holding the type specimen of the longest insect ever seen on Earth, which was just formally described this year. So the discoveries indeed are startling and fast coming. We also need to make a declaration of interdependence. Unlike many other sciences, taxonomy is planetary in scale and can only be done well when it crosses national borders. We need to coordinate collection development around the world because no collection, even though the places like the British Museum and Paris made a good run at it in the 19th century, today it's inconceivable that we could come up with a single comprehensive collection anywhere. However, by coordinating the efforts carefully in all of our natural history collections, we can assure that we maximize the number of species that are ultimately represented in those collections. We need also collaboration among experts to accelerate species discovery and description and testing. And we need nations to recognize this interdependence. And the restrictions that have been placed on sampling and collecting for taxonomists around the world, well-intentioned as they may have been, have the net effect of assuring ignorance of the very countries that throw these regulations up to restrict collecting. So what we need is for taxonomic purposes to loosen those restrictions so that we can collect and test hypotheses of species and clades everywhere. But then the equally important burden is that we have open access to whatever conclusions we come to. The taxonomic community has to be completely open and transparent with whatever it discovers from these so that those host countries have the full benefit of those discoveries. If we just increased the current rate of species discovery and description by one order of magnitude to about 200,000 species a year, which is very feasible given the emerging cyber infrastructure and new generation of tools, and with things like planetary biodiversity inventory showing that teams of taxonomists working together can also accelerate the rate of species description dramatically, we could easily describe an additional 8 million species by the middle of this century. So it starts to make the problem look a lot more manageable. The first step in this, I'd submit, is to build a species observatory. That is, link all the resources that taxonomists need rapid and constant access to do their work quickly and efficiently and well. We need a new organization for taxon experts to come together and work efficiently as communities. We need a clearly stated agenda for the taxonomic community, at the heart of which is answering that first and most fundamental of all questions of biodiversity, what are Earth species? And we need to really focus on the intersection of this strong, independent, well-supported, well-funded science with the various user groups, and especially the evolutionary and environmental sciences. This species observatory should link all the existing museums and botanical gardens, a new generation of cyber infrastructure-driven tools such as telemicroscopy, image archives, various databases, cyber conferencing tools, a new generation of software to make production of electronic monographs faster and more efficient, and so forth. And then this central resource, this observatory, becomes an incredible research platform that can vastly accelerate the testing of known species, the discovery of new species, and the access of all species through portals like Encyclopedia of Life to broad user communities. The concept borrowed from computer science of knowledge communities fits well with the task at hand. What we need to do is build this core cyber infrastructure, core physical collections of specimens, and then around this, organize and fund the international community of taxon experts. Given our 250-year history of working as fiercely independent scholars, it's critical that we always have the ability for individual rogue taxonomists to keep doing that which they've always done well, and that can easily be accommodated in this system. They have complete access to these resources, and they contribute back to this community-owned knowledge of a taxon. On the other hand, teams of taxonomists can come together to work more efficiently and rapidly on particular subtaxa. This cyber taxonomy will be built on the foundation of collections on a cyber infrastructure specifically aimed at meeting the needs of taxonomists and paying particular attention first to the fundamental taxonomy that generates that general reference system and from which applied taxonomy can be accessed by any users who can make use of it. Well, we can't do this alone. We need partners with diverse expertise. We need to work with computer scientists and engineers to design and implement cyber infrastructure and new digital tools. We need to work with sociologists to figure out how to get along with each other long enough to solve taxonomic problems. We need those sociologists to help us convince other biologists that there is science beyond experimentalism. And we can't do this without specialization and cooperation. Over the last 20 years, I would argue that we've increasingly tried to homogenize what a good modern taxonomist looks like. When I was at the NSF, even the dissertation improvement grants for students pretty much was like a Chinese laundry list where you had to do some molecules, you had to do some morphology, you had to do some field work, had to visit a few museums. All this is fine, and for those individuals inclined to do all those things, that is fine as well. But I would argue there's ample room for specialization with at least three or four more million insects out there to be discovered and described. I think we can afford to specialize and not get too hung up on everyone doing everything. And in this regard, about a week ago, Bert Holdobler and Ed Wilson launched their latest book in Tempe at the Desert Botanical Garden. It's called The Superorganism. And listening to Bert's lecture, struck me that what he was describing was cyber taxonomy. He didn't know this, and he would disavow it if I told him. But when he gave his talk about superorganisms and using ants as the illustration, he noted that in primitive colonies, there's constant struggle and fight going on within the colony where youngsters are constantly trying to unseat the queen, which eventually she becomes physiologically frail and they succeed, and then you get a new queen, but this constant battle's going on within the nest. By contrast, the higher, more highly evolved and efficient superorganisms, Bert characterized as being a distributed network of individuals who shared a common purpose, had an efficient, effective communication system, and achieved enormous productivity and efficiency through specialization and sheer numbers. Well, this analogy certainly isn't original with me, although I thought it was a week ago. Since then, I realized that Kevin Kelly pointed out that the rapidly increasing sum of all computational devices in the world connected online itself forms a superorganism of computation with its own emergent behaviors. So there seems to be a general sort of awareness here of this potential. So if we were to compare existing taxonomic practices with those primitive nests where the reigning expert is the most recent writer of a revision or a monograph, and there are upstart students constantly trying to do a better job with the next monograph and become the reigning authority, That has served us incredibly well for 200 years, but it also has resulted in a system where we actually replace that queen of knowledge only maybe once every 50 years in entomology, and we just can't work at that pace in light of the biodiversity crisis. So think about that analogy. I think it's really interesting to think of the network being these knowledge communities, the communication provided by the internet and cyber infrastructure, the CAS represented by our specialization, where we have specialized morphologists and molecular systematists and collectors and down the line, and of course the shared purpose of discovering and describing Earth species. Now I want to conclude by telling you a few of the things we're doing at the International Institute for Species Exploration and what some of our plans are. And one of the things I'm going to mention, actually, I want to commend the Emeritus group, because we actually have a symposium along identical lines in February, as I'll mention in a moment. So brilliant minds think alike. I like that idea very much. Our focus is on morphology and on descriptive taxonomy, on transdisciplinary solutions to the problems of taxonomy, and on building partnerships. We've signed MOUs with a growing list of national and international leading museums and botanical gardens. This is where the best taxonomy is, and hopefully in the future will always continue to be done predominantly. If we can play a role at the Institute, it's to be a catalyst for some changes in how we work and perhaps some of the tools we use. Right now, we're organized conceptually around 6 points: collections and inventories, revisions and monographs, cyber infrastructure and instrumentation, history and philosophy of taxonomy, sociology of taxonomy, and public awareness campaigns. The history and philosophy of taxonomy is critical, and we had a workshop last year, and there's actually a book in development on the past, present, and future of taxonomy, because if we don't understand how taxonomy was allowed to come off the rails in the face of the biodiversity crisis, we may not have much hope to prevent that happening again in the future. So we really have to understand what happened to make sure it never happens again. And I've already mentioned what I think is the importance of sociologists seriously helping us organize these taxon knowledge communities to be as efficient as they can while recognizing the individual contributions of scholars around the world. I'm going to focus primarily in the following concluding comments just on the public awareness campaign. And I want to first mention why I think it's important that we take the revolution to the people. First is my anecdotal observation that most of our fellow biologists are not heavily burdened with altruism, and I'm not willing to wait until they decide to share grants with taxonomy. More importantly, I think the public is predisposed to receive our message, to be incredibly supportive and excited about the taxonomic agenda. The Institute for Social Science Research at Arizona State last December was doing a public opinion poll in the Southwest. And these things are elaborate and they're expensive to do if they're done statistically well. This was like a $50,000 poll. Being dean, I said, gee, do you think we could put a couple of questions about taxonomy in that? And they, of course, said, yes, being one of the units in my college. And and so, you know, the poor respondents answered about 50 questions about politics and economics and then suddenly was hit with taxonomy at the end. But I got the data I wanted, and it confirmed my suspicions. 84% of the respondents had a somewhat or very favorable impression of the importance of taxonomy. Even more encouragingly, 87% thought that species exploration should be a high priority for science. And I think those are really encouraging numbers, and that if we just share with the public what's happening with the biodiversity crisis, what's happening to our museums, what's happening to our taxon expertise, that we can literally get a groundswell of support for taxonomy and for rebuilding the traditional missions of our museums and botanical gardens. I think most of you have suffered through Planet Bob by now, so I'm mercifully not going to play it for you, but this was our first public awareness campaign. And we've gotten a lot of good feedback from that. The second one was naming a new species, Erectocylus orbisonorum, after Roy and Barbara Orbison. And the reason we did this is that the ASU Center for Popular Culture and Media was organizing a tribute concert in the memory of Roy Orbison. They had invited Barbara Orbison to come. There was an original classical music score performed by a string quartet that was very moving. There was a rockabilly band from LA that played other Orbison tunes. And we had this original work of art done by a local artist, Charles Kasilek. It's entitled Whirligig, and we presented this to Barbara Orbison at the event, and she said, "I've never had an award like this before," which I took to be complimentary. but for our purposes, it served the bill. This actually made the online cover of Rolling Stone, and you know you've arrived as a taxonomist when you make Rolling Stone. But the important point there is that it brought awareness of taxonomy, of the fact that there are new species, of the fact that somebody gets to name these things, to an audience that had never thought about this before and certainly didn't know that they needed to know it. Jointly with the International Plant Names Index and the International Commission on Zoological Nomenclature last year, we launched what we call the SOS report, the State of Observed Species. And annually we summarize how many new species have been described in major taxa, again for general public consumption. All these numbers exist already. The hard work and heavy lifting is done by IPNI and ICZN, and so we're simply packaging it for reporters. Recognizing that reporters were not waiting for this good news, we appointed an international committee of taxonomists to pick the top 10 new species. I'm here to tell you, if you want reporters to pick up a story and print it all over the world, just use top 10 whatever, doesn't matter. They so tune into top 10. This thing spread like wildfire. We just got the most fantastic coverage, and so we're just very pleased, and we're working on next year's already. We have an annual systematic symposium and or workshop, depending on the format. Last year, as I say, we looked at the past, present, and future of taxonomy. That was the formal launch of the Institute. This year, we're looking at the adventures and misadventures in species exploration. And we also use the Indiana Jones thing. So we need to, we'll exchange lists of potential speakers. In our case, we're editing a book, and the book is aimed at high school and freshman sort of level readers. To do what Lois was saying, to show them this is actually an exciting, sexy, sometimes death-defying activity. And I think if kids recognize that, they'll look at taxonomy rather differently. Jointly with the Linnaean Society of London, we give a Linnaean Legacy Award each year, and we invite the recipient to come to Tempe and to give a public lecture. Last year, Norm Platnick received the first one. And in February, Richard Forty is coming from the Natural History Museum to receive the second award. Jointly with Sandy Knapp in the Botany Department at the Natural History Museum, we've done a book called Letters to Linnaeus, and we wanted to show something, this sort of bridges the sciences and the humanities. We wanted to show something of the human side of taxonomy. And so we invited 50 authors, mostly taxonomists and distinguished scientists, a few outliers, including Hugh Downs, who was involved in Planet Bob, and so, you know, we're keeping the association going. And this has turned out beautifully. It exceeded my expectations. Some of the letters are like lectures to Linnaeus. I mean, really telling him this important theoretical stuff he needs to know and he missed out on. At the other extreme is really heart-touching stories from people's childhood when they first discovered their love of natural history and so forth, and sharing that with Linnaeus and how his names allowed them to pursue those interests. And then also humor. Dennis Stevenson, who's vice president for research at the New York Bot Garden, Dennis did a great letter where he writes a letter as if he's on a committee considering Linnaeus for emeritus status. And he points out he hasn't had any NSF grants, he doesn't publish in high impact journals, and his work is almost certainly to have no lasting value. The one current project we're working on that I'm especially excited about, I'm working with a group of students from our business school, the Cary Business School, and they're designing a business plan for me, so this thing will be self-sustaining. I'm willing to put money in for a couple years to launch it, but I don't want a ball and chain here. It has to support itself. And then I'm working with a group of seniors who are computer programmers, and for their senior capstone project, they're actually going to build the website we want. And what we're doing is building a species exploration bank. And so it's like microbanks that you've seen where you can help a Guatemalan woman start a basket weaving company for $50. In this case, we're going to help starving taxonomists get to those rare field sites where they can discover new species. And so we're designing the software so that people who want to do something, be involved about biodiversity, can make very modest investments. Scientists and students who need small amounts of money to do profoundly important things in taxonomy can post those projects and try to entice investors to choose theirs. And then we'll close the loop with pictures and information about the species that have been discovered and so forth, and make the investors feel good so they'll hopefully come back and invest more. And then finally, we're partnering with the Institute for Human Origins, which is Don. We have Don Johansson at ASU, who discovered Lucy. And he has this incredible set of wealthy groupies that follow him around. And so I'm trying to get to know these wealthy groupies. And so we're sponsoring a voyage to the Galapagos as a fundraiser. And we've already raised a substantial amount of money. If we finish filling the vessel, we'll raise even more for our two institutes. But that's it. Thank you very much for your attention. Any questions? Sam and I will be glad to entertain them. Yeah.
What do you see the role of the International Commission in accepting electronic and cyber publications?
Yeah. I mean, I personally share something that I'm not sure what your position is, but I know a lot of people. I'm just deathly afraid of the permanency. I mean, when I moved out of my office at Cornell to go to London, I found a big stack of Bernoulli cartridges from the early 80s, and I don't think you could find a functional Bernoulli drive anywhere on the planet to read those things. And seeing the fashion come and go in universities and even in museums about what's important, blind faith that someone will continue to fund the constant upgrade as technology progresses and so forth for these things, I think it's frightening. If someone can convince us that true archives, I mean things that will last for 1,000 years, are there, then we'd be fools not to jump into that quickly. For the time being, you know, some acid-free paper printed upon and deposited somewhere, I think wouldn't be a bad backup. And I don't think that's a very big price to pay for an ultimate fail-safe, just in case. But we clearly have to move. And if we're going to increase the pace of species discovery and description, we have to embrace electronic tools. We just and that can even accelerate just the review process. If I submit a manuscript and you're automatically alerted to it and can review it, you know, we can really expedite the speed with which we make this information accessible. Yes.
Two questions. First is, do you have an idea of the cost of discovering and describing 200,000 species per year in terms of manpower and money? And second question is, what's the role of revisionist taxonomy under the structure of cyber taxonomy?
Yeah, but for me, the role of revisionary taxonomy is hypothesis testing. It's very inefficient to test one species hypothesis at a time, because you have to look at all the species that could potentially be confused with it, and so you basically have to revise several species just to answer one thing. So that's why revisions and monographs were an incredibly brilliant, high throughput, efficient way of testing multiple hypotheses simultaneously, and in electronic form it can be even more. So I don't have a quantification of the costs. A number of years ago, Ed Wilson quantified what he thought would be the cost, and he did work out somehow a cost per species. I don't recall offhand what that was. Maybe someone here does. But compared to other large science projects, I'm willing to wager it's fairly inexpensive. And in terms of payback, future generations will build monuments to us if we actually empower them to know this much about biodiversity, as they're confronting more and more complex and numerous environmental issues, totally ignorant because we couldn't be bothered to go out and collect this stuff. Yeah, John.
I just wanted to comment on going back to Wilson's figure, is that kind of apropos at the moment. You know, he also compared it to the savings and loan buyout that occurred just before he published that. He said it was like what they put into banks, and you think of what they just invested in the insurance companies and other things just now, for banks.
Call your congressman.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Quentin. I have a plaque for you now, which is like inscribed with the sentence "ESA Systematics Evolution and Biodiversity Section recognizes Dr. Quentin D. Wheeler, presenter of the 2008 invited lecture "Unrepentant Taxonomy for the 21st Century," 2008 ESA Annual Meeting, Reno, Nevada.
Thank you.